most restaurant meals are somewhere between pretty good and sort of bad. It's really, really hard to have a truly exceptional night out at a restaurant, from food and service on down. It's also really hard to have a truly terrible, terrible meal. They're pretty rare, which is why you end up talking about them to your friends so often. And so if everything kind of lives in this murky middle, then what else is there to actually say that is going to be definable and unique to you and the way that you want to tell a story? And so most restaurants have an amazing story behind them, whether that's the people, or the place they are, the history that they've connected to, or the community in which they reside. And that's where the meat is for me. I love, even to this day in my new role and have loved for years, the opportunity to tell stories that matter and to highlight people of consequence in the place where they already are.
Today on the LA Food Podcast, I'm your host, Luca Servodio, hoping you got more treats than tricks this Halloween, dear listener. Assuming that tricks aren't your thing, of course. Speaking of treats, though, we're joined today by Farley Elliott, one of Los Angeles' preeminent voices in food media. Farley's been bringing us mouth-watering stories for more than a decade via the likes of LAist, LA Weekly, and, more recently, in his capacity as senior editor of Eater LA. Farley recently announced that he'd be leaving Eater for a new adventure as the SoCal bureau chief of SF Gate, where he's already gotten off to a fast start, covering interesting topics ranging from In-N-Out Burger's reclusive founder to the LA dude who went viral for ordering a scooped, gluten-free bagel at a New York City bagel shop. Shame, shame, I know your name. Farley tells us the story of how he went from eating poutine and Thousand Island dressing on his family's dairy farm in upstate New York to traversing the Southland for the tastiest bites and stories our region has to offer. It's a conversation full of delicious anecdotes, lessons learned, and thoughtful reflections on what it means to report on food and restaurants in a city like Los Angeles, and what he hopes to accomplish in his new role with SF Gate. And oh yeah, there's even a bit about a viral video featuring tiny hamsters eating tiny burritos. Don't say I never gave you anything, dear listener. Without further ado, let's chow down. I am beyond excited to be joined today on the LA Food Podcast by the former senior editor for Eater Los Angeles and the recently announced California bureau chief for SF Gate. It's Farley Elliott. Farley, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. How about yourself?
I'm doing awesome. Thank you for joining us. Where are you calling us from today?
I'm on the general east side, as you would say. So sort of Eagle Rock, Highland Park, Pasadena area.
Dude, we're neighbors.
Oh, there we go. You probably live at, you know, Flamingo Estate with all the other rich people in the huge staircase. I get it. I get it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, munching on our Queen Street Los Angeles oysters that we got delivered from DoorDash.
Yeah. Here's the real secret that I think people who only live in the neighborhood will actually tell you. Obviously, the best restaurant in Highland Park is Joy on York. I guess I would say the second best restaurant at this point is Gold Burger. The third best restaurant, though, is Roasty, the Peruvian chicken place on Figueroa. And if you disagree, you're simply wrong.
I have actually never been to Roasty, which is a big, you know, blunder of mine.
it's a sleeper hit. I'm sort of half kidding. Obviously, there are a million fantastic restaurants, the new Amiga More among them, Home States, there's Highly Likely coming. There's really no end to the possibilities.
My sleeper hit for the Nabes is El Huarache Azteca, which I think just every time I go, I'm like, how is this not the number one restaurant in the world on the world's 50 best?
It's vital. It's beautiful. It's classic. It's colorful. That's a really great answer.
Good. Glad you liked it. Speaking of, what did you have for lunch today?
Oh, you're asking the wrong guy. Lunch at home when I'm not out and about is like whatever scroungy thing I can make for myself and my small family. So it was like handfuls of roasted sweet potatoes. We love doing some like seared cabbage at home. It's really, it's less fun than you would think, but it's because I'm saving all of that energy for going out into the world and eating too much there.
That makes sense. I mean, there's something to be said for just hitting up your fridge and trying to create something tasty. Have you ever thought of publishing one of your impromptu recipes on social media?
No, gosh, no, I couldn't imagine. I leave all of that to the professionals and wannabe professionals. You know, I spent 8.5 years at Eater, and it's a beautiful, creative place. One of the most fulfilling jobs I think you could have in the world. And in that role, I would constantly have to bat away all of the PR people who wanted to talk about grocery store items or at-home cooking. Even during the pandemic, I had to remind people that, like, I focus writing on restaurants, physical spaces out in the world where transactionally you exchange a little bit of money for some type of prepared good. That's the world I actually like to live in. Everything else I leave to other professionals.
Yeah, Eater doesn't really do that, the whole like cooking angle. Sometimes there's like, is there a little bit of product placement here and there?
No, I mean, listen, you're stumbling into a huge ecosystem, obviously. The Eater Los Angeles side, most of what we call the city sites, there's 20 of them across America. Those places are really focused externally. The only time that we would do in-home stuff, I guess, is sort of holiday, not product placement, but like roundups of where to get gift guide kind of things. And even that usually has some sort of a restaurant bent. You can get make at home noodles from Woon, or you can get Momofuku chili crisp, or whatever the case may be. But purely like product stuff, things you buy off the shelf, never, never, never. Eater.com does more home cooking, does more like they might review a television show that has to do with food, things like that. But for the local city sites, we're out there on the beat all the time.
Boots on the ground, if you will.
Exactly.
So Farley, speaking of boots on the ground, did you grow up in Los Angeles?
I did not. I am from a very, very, very small town in northern New York, all the way up on like the Canadian border, about 20 minutes from the border, not far from, say, Montreal.
Is it the kind of thing where you had to take out-of-town guests to Niagara Falls a lot?
No. So like if you think about the state of New York, it's kind of a backwards L. And so instead of being on the horizontal end, I was on the vertical end, like all the way up at the very, very top, about 3-ish hours from Buffalo.
Okay, does that still qualify you as a Buffalo Bills fan, though?
Very great question. I technically am a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. I lived in and around Pittsburgh from like 10 to 15. But the first football game I ever went to was the Buffalo Bills. Up where my family lives still, it's a mix between New York Giants, a little bit of Jets, and Buffalo. It's really kind of a no man's land, as it were. To be honest with you, like the more insane question is like, what are my cultural and music references? Because half of those I feel like are Canadian from when I grew up. Like the Tragically Hip is one of my favorite bands of all time, and they're like Canadian royalty. We grew up watching Hockey Night in Canada, eating a lot of poutine, all this stuff, but just barely on the New York side.
That's interesting. I was going to say, like, so what bands does that mean? Are we talking like Bare Naked Ladies here? Are they Canadian?
Huge Bare Naked Ladies. Absolutely. Just that kind of mix of, I don't know, like these few bands that managed to break through, these few cultural references. I feel like there were children's shows that I watched as a kid that were not American at all, like The Raccoons, that just have no meaning to anyone else anywhere. But it definitely identified a lot of my childhood. I grew up going ice fishing, living in the woods, like very, very, very lumberjacky sort of stuff.
Wow, it's like the best of both worlds. You get to do all that, but you don't have to say sorry after everything.
Yeah, exactly. There's instead of sorry, the sort of very local regionalism we would have is instead of saying, how are you today? I'm doing well. How are you? Most people where I grew up just sort of cut right into saying good and you as a way of an introduction. So it's sort of polite adjacent.
I love that. Polite adjacent. Well, now you completely have left the polite behind by moving to Los Angeles. Were you into food as a child? You mentioned poutine. Was it something you were excited about, or was it just something that happened to be around?
Yeah, so I grew up on a dairy farm, like milking cows before school, and then that went away when I was just under 10, and my dad got back into what was has long been the family business, which literally is lumberjacking, climbing trees, that whole thing. I'm one of 6 kids. I'm the first person in my family to like complete a 4-year college degree. It's a very different life out there. There's 0 restaurants in the town that I grew up in and 1 stoplight. So no real sense of like dining and kind of what that meant. I've always been a big eater, a happy eater, a curious person. I think those things end up feeding my curiosity for the job that I'm in now and the job I had at Eater for a very long time. But I didn't grow up living in or loving restaurants the way a lot of other people did.
Did you grow up spending any time in the kitchen?
Not really. You know, it was just kind of catch as you can, like running outside in the wilderness, being a Boy Scout, sleeping in the woods, like that sort of stuff. And I'm the third oldest, so I have an older brother and an older sister. My older brother is, you know, 6'5", 320 pounds. Like, he's a lumberjack. And if you don't eat it, he will. So you've got to kind of, you know, marry the best of both worlds, where like you want something quality, but you also want to operate at speed. I will say there are a few sort of colloquial local food traditions. Basically, every gas station you go to has cheese curd and like a little ice tray next to the checkout stand. There are a bunch of places that serve poutine. The diner that like I still go to when I go back home, Graham's Diner, the first page of that menu is just various types of poutine. I used to have a poutine vanity license plate in Los Angeles. So there are some very cultural references. And I will say, and this is one really for the heads, the St. Lawrence River that goes out past Montreal and dumps out into Lake Ontario, that mouth of that outlet into Lake Ontario is called the Thousand Islands region. That's where I'm from. And it is indeed where Thousand Islands dressing is from.
It's no a real place. Way. Is there a story there as to how it was created?
You know, conflicting stories, as usual with these types of old things. The generally accepted one is that John Jacob Astor used to, very famous New York person, a lot of rich people downstate have like houses up there, and there's all these islands, of course, as the name would surmise, that people put summertime homes on and things like that. He had a big sprawling mansion. The Skull and Bone Society has a mansion that they own out there. And he was throwing a party one night for a bunch of regal downstate folks, and he demanded his chef come up with some new sauce to serve with dinner and an accompanying salad. And that chef whipped up the Thousand Islands dressing that we know today. He loved it so much, took it back down to New York City, introduced it at the Waldorf Astoria, and it was gone from there. Now, the sort of food writer in me has to add the little button here, which is years ago for Eater, I was in Taipei in Taiwan working on some stories with a colleague of mine, and I'm sitting in this fancy, beautiful hotel in the center of Taiwan, and I'm just sort of remarking to myself as I wait for my colleague to come down that, like, man, I'm a kid who made it. You know, I grew up in a town of 400 people, and now for a living, I get to be a writer. And not only that, this job has taken me to the other side of the world. And I'm having this sort of beautiful moment in reflecting on all the great things that's been given to me in my life. And there's a little buffet in one corner of the room, and I look at all these beautiful delicacies from all over the world. And at the end of the table is a big bowl of Thousand Islands dressing. And I just was
oh my God.
Man, I worked so hard to get here, and the salad dressing beat me. You know what I mean?
That salad dressing is its ancestors' wildest dreams, let's be honest.
Exactly.
Farley, what brought you to Los Angeles all the way from northern New York's finest dairy farms?
Yeah, very circuitous route. I had a friend who happened to be in California when I was, he was like my older brother's friend, so I sort of knew him. He's a couple years older than me. He had gone to California on a whim. He always wanted to live in California. And I did 2 years at a community college. I'm very pro community college. I have a lot to say on the subject. I did 2 years at a community college in Northern New York and knew that I needed to go to a 4-year institution somewhere because there was nobody ahead of me in my family that had gone through this process. It was very much left up to me. And he ended up in San Luis Obispo and we had stayed in contact. And he's like, man, it's beautiful here. You got to come out. I took like what I think was my second flight ever in my life out to California to meet this guy, and then loved it. Was like, I need to go to a 4-year institution. I can be poor anywhere. I'm going to be poor by the beach. So let me see if I can figure out how to get late admission to school and just live in California. And so that's what I did. I was a theater major at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. And then after that, I had a bunch of friends who moved down to Los Angeles and I moved with them. And here we are.
That's a beautiful, beautiful place to land, San Luis Obispo. It also feels like a good transition from dairy farm to California, given the fact that it's got wine country. You know, tri-tip is the natural food to consume there as well, which feels somehow Northern New York as well.
Well, I would tell you the more important thing was like the scale of it. If I had moved to like UCLA, it would have freaked me out. I would have been too small in such a big world and it wouldn't have worked. I moved to San Luis Obispo and I was like, man, y'all got two Denny's. This is unbelievable. And that was like the transition that I needed, you know?
That's amazing. Two Denny's? Like, which one do you go to?
Well, there was always a worse Denny's. Everyone knows there's a good Denny's and a bad Denny's.
Yeah, totally. What did you want to be at this point? Did you want to be a writer?
Yeah, I was always a writerly guy. Like, even as a little kid, I have these old newspaper clippings of me in like fourth and fifth grade submitting little short stories to the local newspaper. Like, I always just enjoyed storytelling and trying to craft phrases and feeling like I could use my intelligence to have something to say and build an audience. So I wanted to be a television and comedy writer. That was like my first big foray in Los Angeles. I worked a day job and then I got through the system at UCB and got on a house team and did comedy shows and made a little bit of money doing that. I did some touring comedy stuff, whatever. And then eventually what happened, and this is 100% true, like I was sitting in the green room before a show one night at UCB and I had started making a little bit of money doing various writing gigs for comedy. And I had my day job and I was getting a little bit of money for freelance food and other culture writing around LA, which is its own sort of separate entry point. But I realized one night I was sitting in this green room that all my friends who had TV writing jobs, all I wanted to do was ask them like, how did you do it? You know, like reveal the secret pocket in your coat that has all of the answers to the test. And all those people wanted from me was to ask me where I'd eaten recently. And I was like, oh, I'm in the wrong line of work. Like, I need to stop chasing and I need to start delivering. And that was the real snap light bulb moment that set me on the path to trying to just do food full time.
That's so interesting. So it's like you were chasing the action only to realize you were in the heart of the action itself.
Yeah. People are already asking me, you're at the center of this thing or close to it from their perspective. So why not just fulfill what they are asking of me instead of feeling like I need to go be somebody else?
Mm-hmm. Totally. That makes sense. What attracted you about food writing specifically?
I mean, the not so secret thing with me is that like food is good. Everybody likes food. We enjoy talking about a great hot dog we just had or whatever the thing is. But ultimately, I really believe this, that most restaurant meals are somewhere between pretty good and sort of bad. It's really, really hard to have a truly exceptional night out at a restaurant from food and service on down. It's also really hard to have a truly terrible, terrible meal. They're pretty rare, which is why you end up talking about them to your friends so often. And so if everything kind of lives in this murky middle, then what else is there to actually say that is going to be definable and unique to you and the way that you want to tell a story? And so most restaurants have an amazing story behind them, whether that's the people, the place they are, the history that they've connected to, or the community in which they reside. And that's where the meat is for me. I love, even to this day in my new role and have loved for years, the opportunity to tell stories that matter and to highlight people of consequence in the place where they already are.
That's really interesting. I'd never heard it framed that way in terms of the sort of like range of like middle to pretty good restaurant meal, which makes me think when you see a restaurant review that is so negative, like, you know, we're talking like famously the Guy Fieri review that was done in the New York Times, I think a few years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Like, are you saying that when we see those reviews, it's true, like chances are that that critic had stumbled across something truly horrible, or sometimes are they sort of just being negative because it doesn't meet expectations? Or like, what are we seeing there when we see negative reviews?
Well, yeah, now you're getting into an even kind of more exploratory topic. And I should just sort of reaffirm at the top here, like, I'm not a food critic. My job is not to write in the first person. I don't use I statements. I don't say, oh, the green beans were bad tonight. Like in my traditional role, it is covering people in places in a newsier sense. This place opened, this place closed. Here's a trend that we're seeing. Here's 10 places to go eat a burrito, whatever the thing is. And so it is less the role of trying to actually slam a place or in many cases, elevate a place. We have to have hard conversations. Of course, there are bad actors in the industry and we tell those stories the way any journalist would. But I am not out here trying to say like, I wish you made your ham sandwich slightly less salty. Like, I don't have the skill set for that. I don't have the taste buds for that. I think the people who do that have a tremendously hard job on their hands. So that being said, there are different ways to approach that role. The Pete Wells review that you're talking about, you know, it's formatted and written in such a way that he wants to evoke a response. And he got exactly that. The idea that it is probably the most pointed to negative review of the modern era means that he's won. But someone like Bill Addison for the Los Angeles Times, who is mostly trying to tell deeply intricate stories about why a place sort of meets a mark or fails and what could be done to improve it is a very different and more gentle approach. And frankly, it's one I connect to more deeply. Bill is a longtime friend and former colleague. And I also think that he writes so beautifully about food that it can kind of transcend whether or not a meal is quote unquote worth it. And we can have conversations about what worth it actually is in the modern age. But you know, to the Yelp side of things, I almost never look at the reviews on Yelp or even really the stars. The reality is it's the greatest restaurant database the world has ever known. If you don't know where to eat in a particular neighborhood, you can type in lunch and things will come up. But the notion that you should follow the stars or the guidance of an anonymous person, I don't subscribe to.
Yeah, I think I feel the same way. What strikes me about what you just said when you were talking about the types of stories you cover is you were very adamant to say you're not a food critic. However, one of the types of stories you brought up was this notion, which we've spoken about it before on this podcast, of listicles, of where to find 10 best burritos. And to me, that's where the line gets a little bit blurred, because maybe it is not your intention to be a food critic, right? But I think that the way that people perceive that, the mass population, they are perceiving those lists to be, oh, this person is telling me this is a good place, which has been the role of a food critic traditionally, right? So we're starting to see a little bit of blurred lines. I'm just wondering, how do you negotiate that? How do you navigate that?
This is a great question, and one that doesn't get brought up often enough, frankly. There is a curatorial element to any list that you see anywhere, right? There's roughly 40,000 places to eat in Los Angeles County, depending on how many street food vendors you want to include. If you are doing a list or some sort of a collection of the best tacos in Los Angeles, one, it's got best in the title, which already makes it curatorial and somewhat personal, but it also is never going to be completely inclusive of the entire scope of tacos available to you in Los Angeles County, let alone Orange County, the Inland Empire, or anywhere else. So you're absolutely right. In that sense, we are being tasked with giving people a shortened and condensed version of information that they're seeking. And I think some of that is just the way the modern internet spins these days. Lists are the underpinning for almost any food site that you are going to interact with that is not purely recipe-based. That's why the New York Times still does lists of places to eat in Los Angeles right now or whatever. I think some of that is just sort of it is the way that it is. And we try to speak objectively about the food and the experience within the content of each individual map point that we discuss. But yeah, there is a little bit of the sort of less than firm line where we also write things called highly opinionated on the site, which is like the one and only exception where I would talk about what I think is the best breakfast burrito in Los Angeles. Those are clearly marked, and it's not advertorial, but it's the same sort of similar idea, the way that you would demarcate something as an opinion. But other than that, those are kind of small examples that prove an exception rather than the reality of the job, which is very different most of the time.
I love those series, the highly opinionated series. It's how I found my favorite banh mi that I've had recently, Wet Thai Bakery in San Gabriel Valley. But it's also how I get my blood boiling when I really disagree with something, you know, which I think is like an important purpose that those kinds of articles serve too. It's almost like to start a debate.
Yeah, they can be. Absolutely. And that's why it's highly opinionated right in the eyebrow there. I'm not a person who loves to chase that sort of stuff. I think if you asked me 6, 8, 10 years ago when I was freelancing around, I would have felt very differently. I believed at the time that the way that you break into the industry is to scream really loudly and to have a bunch of data to back it up. I'm a type A person. If I go to one place, I want to go to two for comparison, and then I want to go to 1,000 because why not? But more and more, I find myself, like a lot of food writers who continue to age into this business, that I just want to tell more meaningful stories about people and why something they're doing is really great, rather than feeling like I need to crap on the guy next to them, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. You say that you used to think that the way to break in was to scream really loudly. Mm-hmm. What's the advice you would give to someone trying to break in now?
Ooh, I mean, I will tell you, I answer this question once or twice a week. You know, I try to make myself very available to people and let them know that if they have questions about the industry, which is tremendously hard, even harder now to break into than it used to be, that I'm available. Mostly what people are asking is, how do I take your job? To which case I say, like, good luck. The short version that I tell people is, I think you need to find something that you are interested in, that you believe you can cover better than anybody else. and then go and cover that thing repeatedly so that when someone comes and is looking for that information, you're standing on the corner with your arms raised. That can be a particular cuisine. It can be a particular neighborhood. It can be a particular type of person, a history. It can be anything basically that you want it to be. But you just need to become the quote unquote expert of that thing, because people will always look to experts when they want answers. Over the years in my career, I have been called the taco guy. I wrote a book about street food, the street food guy. I'm the burger guy, the hot dog guy, the bagel guy. I'm whatever guy you need me to be, as long as you believe me to be competent enough to pay me money and keep paying attention.
Totally. I think that's fantastic advice, especially this notion of like, I think a lot of people try to enter careers and are just like, they won't do it unless they know that there's some sort of guarantee that there's going to be like a job or a paycheck at the other end. And it's like, if you really love it, just do it. And the moment you stop loving it, maybe it's not for you anymore. Maybe you wouldn't want a paycheck to do it.
Yeah, and maybe you can change the format in which the information appears. People have gone from blogs to freelance writing to Instagram to vlogs to TikTok and back again. There are so many ways in which you can continue to find enjoyment, hopefully, out of the thing that you're doing. If you're definitely chasing it for a paycheck, I wouldn't recommend a single job in media, but that's okay. Like it does offer some benefits and some advantages, absolutely. And ultimately, I think the scene has shrunk tremendously from when I started and continues to consolidate around a few big brands. And that's why it was, and we'll get to this later, important for me to bring a new brand to Los Angeles to continue to tell stories rather than just moving across town and taking somebody else's seat at a competing outlet from Eater or whatever.
Before we get there, I want to hear about how you found your way to Eater and to the work that you've been doing so meaningfully for the past 8 years.
Yeah. So I thank you for saying that, by the way. I had a day job for a very long time, a job I got off Craigslist. Like in the interview process, I told the people like, hey, I'm going to be a writer someday. Like I would love to help you guys out as much as possible, but just know I'm not going to stay here long term, which is truly the worst thing you should say in an interview. And they were like, okay, never give this guy a raise, but it was fine. I worked there for like 4.5 years and they were really amazing to me when I left and helped me transition out really seamlessly. So basically like, and I want to preface this all by saying, I'm a 6'3" white dude who lives in Los Angeles, California. I didn't have any financial backing, paid all my own student loans, whatever the thing is, but it's still only my path. And some areas of that are easier than it would be for anybody else. That being said, I started working for free, writing random stories for like LAist back in like 2008, basically. They had an open call asking for people to write about comedy and movies and, you know, theater productions and any sort of live entertainment like that. And I sent them some clips of things that I had written in college. And they said, sure, go cover this movie review. And I did. And they liked it. And so then I started writing for free. And it wasn't until like the end of that year when we had a big Christmas party and all the LAist people got to come. And there's a bunch of us who all worked for free. And then the editors who got paid a little bit. And then the owners who got paid more. And I said to a person at this party, like, gosh, this is really fun, but I hope to be able to continue to do more. And she's like, well, what are you really interested in right now? And by that time, I had done maybe like 200 different street food vendors. I used to have a little Excel sheet and a Google map, and I'd put pins down and places I wanted to go. And I said, you know, I'm really obsessed with this street food thing lately. And she's like, you know, Farley, we're making $0. You should at least write about the thing you want to write about. You know what I mean? And I was like, oh yeah, that's a really great point. I literally never thought of that before. So then I pitched them on writing some stuff about burgers and tacos and beer, and they said yes to all of it. And that was how I kind of got a byline in the food space and kickstarted the whole thing. I was able to transfer some of that into small paying gigs, whether that was Serious Eats in New York for a number of years or LA Weekly back before it got all weird and crazy when Jonathan Gold was still there and Amy Scattergood was still there. And so you just kind of start to build a resume. And another sort of secret part of this whole career path is that there are entire industries of people on the PR side and the owner-operator side whose job is to find folks who are writing about places and to discover their email and email them all the time to invite them in and entice them to cover their place. So like, you don't have to be doing it all that long as a freelancer before people start to come to you. And a lot of those ideas are worthless, and almost all of them have some sort of a backbone that is actually the intention of a person to try to get you to do what they want you to do. But it is still all to say that like, you can rise and become a sort of known person just by continuing to do it even at a low level for a small amount of time.
when did Eater come knocking on your door, and how did that seem to be like the place that you thought, okay, this actually meshes well with what I'm looking to do?
Yeah, so Eater became a thing in my world probably like 2013. I think I wrote my first piece for them in early 2014. Basically, I had been doing food stuff. I left my job, was able to go full-time freelance, was doing magazine writing and a bunch of other stuff. And because I had been doing the job long enough, I was able to start building relationships with people who knew stuff. And so I got to a point where I was able to start kind of covering news in a way every once in a while for an outlet like LA Weekly. And if there's one thing that Eater has always wanted as the core of its DNA, is to know stuff before anybody else and to report on that stuff. And so once Eater got wind of me writing stuff that they wish they had written, they started to reach out to see if I would write that stuff for them. And that was kind of the beginning of the process. 2015, I went full-time in-house with Eater after writing some stories for them. That was also the year that my book came out. And so I was able to kind of transition fully into a new life as like an in-house person. The last little thing I'll say is, I don't know how long you've been in Los Angeles or been sort of thinking about food and food media, but pre-2015 Eater was a very, very different beast. Do you know this era of Eater?
I was around and following it, but can you remind us what Eater was like back then?
So there were a ton of other competing outlets at the time, not only the Los Angeles Times, LA Weekly, which still had Jonathan Gold, but magazines and Guilt Group and Urban Daddy and just a bunch of places online where people would go and have their stories told. And so Eater was much scrappier as a necessity. They would run up to a window that had a piece of paper torn off of it, and you could peer inside and see what was under construction and take a photo with your phone and then run that about this place being under construction. Like, it was just madness in an early kind of internet bloggy way. And some of that was really positive, and some of it was also a little more negative and a little snarkier, the way that the internet writing was at the time. Eater, and this doesn't get talked about that much anymore, Eater across the board used to have a eyebrow, like a sort of type of story that we would run called Death Watch. Restaurants that were still open, that you would be like, this restaurant is doing poorly and is going to close. Like, before it even closed, just crazy, the more like bleeding edge of what the kind of snark internet used to be. And so I think really, and part of the reason I was hired at Eater in 2015 was just to like try to be a nicer guy. You know, I had already built relationships within the community. And if I could get those people to believe positively that Eater had something to offer in an audience that was curious, that maybe we could sort of turn this thing into something slightly different. And that's not to say that pre-2015 or pre-me getting there, Eater was bad. That's not what I'm saying. Only totally. That like, we were able to steer in a slightly new direction that I think elevated the brand to what it's become in Los Angeles now.
They're like, if this quasi-Canadian dairy farmer can't make us nicer, then nobody can, pretty much, is what they
and
thought.
And I'm going into every restaurant just shouting good and you as soon as I enter, you know?
good and you. That actually, you know, what you just said about Eater, it's something I don't think about often because of how evolved Eater has become today. You know, when we're looking for news to cover on this podcast and just discuss, Eater does seem to be the place where we get most news because they do still have a knack for breaking those stories. But I remember reading in David Chang's book that came out a couple years ago how much he hated Eater when it first was on the scene. Probably, and it has to do probably with the approach that they were taking back then, which
absolutely
makes sense given what the internet was like. It was very much the Wild West.
Yeah, pre-Gawker collapse, like the tone was just very different. And I think that Eater was the sort of snarky blog person on the block that really wanted to cover stuff to death. I mean, we were writing in those early days, I was writing sometimes 5 or 6 stories a day, a couple hundred words, you'd shoot it up and you wanted to, the term at the time was flood the zone. I wanted to cover something so much that there was nothing else for any other competing outlet to cover. So our audience would come to us as a baseline. The other places would stay away and you would build relationships with people that mattered within the space. Sometimes you would have to burn those bridges because it was necessary for a story, but often enough, it would be mutually beneficial that everybody could win. We had an audience that craved it. We had operators that wanted to have people in their building, and we had stories that we wanted to tell. And that's not to say that anybody is in bed necessarily with anybody else, only that it works for all parties. So why not?
Yeah. So how did you see Eater's coverage and approach evolve over the time that you were there? And today, what do you think distinguishes Eater from the other publications that people have available to them?
Yeah, I think primarily for me, I operated in two streams, one of which was Let me cover all the news all the time. Let me be the person who knows everything. I've talked about this before, but I operated for years in this triangle sort of setup. Again, very analytically minded here. The first part of the pyramid was like, I wanted people, operators, workers in restaurants, other diners to see me in these spaces, spending money, being a nice person, right? If I walk into a restaurant and somebody goes, oh, this guy's going to demand a free meal, there goes 120 bucks. Like, that sucks and is bad for business. You don't want to work with somebody like that. The second part of the triangle is like, I want people who read the site to see my name and to think that we do a good job, that we cover stuff well, we cover it before anybody else, and that we're consistently around doing the coverage that they're looking for. And the third part of that triangle is I want owners and operators and people in the know to think that I'm good enough at my job journalistically that I could figure out your secret anyway, even if you don't want to tell me. So if you like me, you think I'm a nice guy, you think I'm good at what I do, and you're maybe like a little bit hesitant to screw me over or a little bit afraid of the abilities that I have, then you'll just come to me directly and we can have a much better working relationship together. So that was really my baseline for years and years. We have a dining budget at Eater. My job is to be out 60, 70 times a month, sometimes more, putting a business card in people's hands and just eating like crazy.
What is unique about doing that in the food world?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a much more in-person element to doing it in the food world. A lot of times the people that you end up getting to know and talking to and building relationships with are people that you are seeing across a dining table or seeing across a kitchen. And it can be really, really gratifying because you get to interact with those people more directly, but it can also be really challenging. Those people are at work. You are presumably there for some version of leisure slash work, and they might be having the worst night of their lives while you're eating a shrimp scampi. And that's not necessarily the best environment. You know, we're not always meeting at a Starbucks to like whisper in each other's ears about big political secrets. So it usually what I have found is the winning attitude is to approach people with honesty and integrity, to let them know who you are and what you're about, and to keep showing up, even if one story or one version of a story gets told somewhere else because that person decided to give it to the LA Times or the New York Times or whoever. That's okay. It's not ideal. It's certainly a bad day in a sense, but it's just one day. And I want people to believe that we have the ability to put butts in seats to meaningfully change how they operate and who they get to see in their dining rooms every night, because we have a huge audience at our back that really, really cares about that sort of stuff. So if you can approach that with grace and keep meeting people where they're at and show them that you're going to be around over time, I think that's how you continue to win. And that's partly why I was at Eater for 8.5 years. I still think it's a job I could have had for 40 years. There's still so much to do and say and talk about, and so many people that I still have great relationships with.
Have you ever felt like the bad guy as the reporter? Do you know what I mean? Like, what I mean is like, when we think about the caricature of reporters, you know, you're not a critic, but famously the critic from the acclaimed Disney film Ratatouille, kind of portrayed as the villain in that film. Do you ever have moments in your career where you feel like we are the baddies now, to use a Monty Python analogy?
I wouldn't say we are the baddies in the sort of largest sense possible, but yeah, not every day is a win. Not every day feels beautiful and great. And I think, unfortunately, in the journalism landscape, if all you are ever doing is writing really nice stories about people, you're ultimately doing it wrong. And that's especially true if you are covering a day-to-day news beat. The reality is there are lots of bad people, some of whom we know about, many of whom we do not, who operate in these spaces that we cover. And when we come across those people, it is an obligation that we have to meaningfully discuss what those people are up to. It's a truncated version, I guess, of like comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. But it's still true in food or politics or anywhere else that that obligation exists. And I have restaurants in Los Angeles that I'll never go back to, that I would be kicked out of probably if I went to. All of that is just part and parcel to the gig. Most of my days are spent meaningfully getting people to understand that there is more to eat in the city than they probably realize. And sometimes it's people who are really crappy to each other, to the world, or to their workers. And that's just part of the game.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's essential, though. The work that you and the rest of the Los Angeles Food Corps have done in the last few years, especially with a lot of the, you know, heinous allegations that have come up against certain restaurants, like, those are important conversations. So I think you encapsulated that beautifully. But moving to a bit more of a happy topic, what is one of your favorite stories that you've covered at Eater, in terms like a moment where you were like, damn, that was a really fun one to write, or I feel like this story really made a difference?
Ooh. Those are almost two side-by-side tracks, I'll say. I still think often about a story that I wrote really early on in my career at Eater about a place that's unfortunately no longer around called Art's Famous Chili Dog. I've talked about this place a little bit, but it's an example kind of at the beginning of this conversation of what I mean when I say that like food is, whether or not it's good, is only kind of one part of the equation. Art's Famous Chili Dog opened in the 1930s. Art Elkin, this guy who came from Chicago and claims to have invented the chili dog in Los Angeles. And he opened this place in South LA back when it was much more like burgeoning aerospace and sort of single-tracked homes and orange groves and things like that. And over the decades, he grew to become a kind of hot dog institution. And his claim to fame was that they removed the casing from the hot dog and they put chili on top of everything. And so instead of getting a snap, it would all sort of meld together inside of the bun. And then you start to see through the 60s and 70s, the finishing of the interstate highway system, the white flight, the deurbanization that happens all across America, and the segregation and racial lines that get drawn as a result, and how South LA, especially that South Central region of South LA, started to become disenfranchised by political leaders. And all along, Art Elkin is getting older. And as the decades go by, you can see the photographs inside the restaurant of him with various local political leaders start to change. And it becomes younger and more radicalized Black men instead of old, happy white men with really wide ties. And Art's there kind of through the whole thing. And by the late 80s and 90s, it becomes the South Central that we know, right? Rap songs, guns, drugs, violence, all the things that you hear. And Art's Famous Chili Dog is still at the center of it all, right at Florence and Normandy. Now, Art dies in 1990, 1992, riots, people going crazy. The city's on the verge of collapse. There is this famous video footage of Reginald Denny, a truck driver who's trying to drive an 18-wheeler through the intersection of Florence and Normandy, and he gets pulled out of the truck and he gets beaten on live TV, and police are unable to stop him from getting injured. And the helicopter, as it's scanning above the scene below, you can see Art's Famous Chili Dog is in the scene. It's literally at the intersection of a flashpoint of racial tension in the center of Los Angeles at one of the most meaningful times in Los Angeles' history. A couple years later, the family is like, we got to get out of here. They sell it to a gentleman who went to the high school nearby, grew up down the street, ran a drug rehabilitation clinic in South LA, a Black gentleman and his wife. And they ran that place just until just before the pandemic unfortunately closed. But I say all of that to say that like this place is so meaningful to Los Angeles, not only for its longevity and its history, but its location, literally like its physical location in the center of the city and everything that it has endured. And whether or not the chili dog is any good doesn't fucking matter. Like it really doesn't. You know what I mean? That's the sort of stuff that I want to continue to talk about as I grow further in this career.
That's really cool. Yeah, I mean, you've written what, 5 stories for SF Gate so far that I've seen at least?
Yeah, I've written a handful. We're still getting up and running. It's early days. We've got some hiring to do. But, you know, those types of featurey things, beautiful, meaningful pieces, hopefully that resonate with an audience, that's really what I want to keep doing. The news is always going to be there, and Eater remains an excellent source for all that sort of stuff. But if I can tell more Art's Famous Chili Dog stories, we're doing something right.
No, that's really cool. And I was just going to say, I can already see the beginnings of that direction, which makes me very, very excited. So, you know, let's get into it. This new exciting gig you have with SF Gate. How did this come about, and why did this seem like the right next step for you?
So yeah, the decision to leave Eater was something that had been a couple of years in the making. I had started to outgrow, frankly, the role. And that's not to say that there isn't enough to cover in Los Angeles or that the team is not good enough for me, or far from it. It's just that you do a job for a long time and you start to wonder what a different version of a similar job might look like. And that was the case for me. And so in figuring out what opportunities were out there, I had started to press a couple of buttons and answer a few phone calls, but nothing really came to fruition. And ultimately, SF Gate came around this summer, decided that they wanted to expand meaningfully into Southern California, and that they were going to build out what amounts to a little tiny bureau desk, which is the desk you see me sitting at now, to cover this city, not just with food, but with culture and travel and the outdoors and other things that also align with my personal interests. And so I really, really believe that one of the best things that I could do in my role at Eater ultimately was to leave. And I know that that sounds maybe weird, but there are so many people who are so great at telling stories who do not have the access or the opportunity because there's only a few jobs at the top. I've been a really high volume writer for Eater for a very long time, made a lot of money for them. It's been very mutually beneficial, all of that sort of stuff. But if ultimately at the 10-year mark, the person who is writing more about Los Angeles food every single day looks like me, we've got a problem. And so I needed to step away to make room for other people, whether that's the amazing Mona Holmes on our team, Kathy Chaplin on the Eater team, whoever. And I'm really proud of the opportunity to get to do that while also, like I said earlier, bringing a new audience to Los Angeles.
I wish Congress thought like that, you know? No, it's very, very, very admirable. It makes sense. I mean, even that decision sounds mutually beneficial. Leaving space for new voices at Eater while going to get to pursue something that sounds like is really interesting and exciting for you. First question on SFgate is, you know, for the uninitiated, it might not immediately make sense why a Northern California publication is interested in doing more about Southern California. What's the rationale there?
Totally. And let me just say that I hear you. And I think that that's part of the beautiful challenge of the job. The way I've been describing it to people is like, the New York Times is already here covering Southern California, right? Nobody bats a lash. The San Francisco Chronicle and SFgate can be here doing the same thing and probably doing it more meaningfully, not only by hiring somebody who lives in Los Angeles like I do, but by knowing what the state already looks like and demands. I think there's plenty of people who live on the East Coast to read the New York Times every day who have no idea that San Francisco is in the center of the state and not at the very top, you know? So there's a lot that we can do already because we're in a privileged position of already being here. The answer to why they wanted to come down here is simply because they think that financially it makes sense and they're eager to grow and expand. They do a lot of page views every single month, many, many more than Eater LA ever did because they're an entire newsroom that also covers sports and politics and all that sort of stuff. It just makes sense. They've identified Los Angeles as a growth market for them, not only for sort of LA curious Bay Area people who have connections here through college or family or something like that, but also with a general internet audience that is curious about meaningful stories being told around Southern California at large. That person could live in Kenosha, Wisconsin, or upstate New York, or Hyderabad or wherever, and they might want to visit Los Angeles and know where the best burger is, or visit Los Angeles and know why to avoid the Walk of Fame. And if we can meaningfully tell those stories, I think there's an audience there, and audiences mean advertising, and advertising means money, and that's the way the world goes around.
I mean, you touched on it right there, but it sounds like you will be writing for a slightly different audience than you were before. How does that impact the way you approach stories?
Yeah, definitely a different audience. It's broader in scope, especially to start, because we've got to build up that base and get back to basics in terms of having people come to the site and trust and understand your brand. And I think that's a really fun challenge that I'm looking forward to. I just wrote a story today that will be up by the time your readers hear this about the In-N-Out heiress and their 75th anniversary party and how she's sort of stepping into the spotlight for the very first time. Now, that's something we probably would have covered at Eater LA, but we would have done it alongside, hey, this known chef from the West Side is finally opening his first East Side spot. Or, hey, here's the big reveal on Queen Street and all of the seafood you can expect inside. Those stories, those last two, are something we're not going to be covering for a while at SFgate. We're thinking much bigger, much more feature friendly, and much more fun in scope. You know, I think there's an audience that wants to just be told, here's this quirky, underground, mysterious, secret thing. You want to be in the know, whatever that sort of headline is, we can work from there to continue to tell meaningful stories about Los Angeles in a way that I had been doing and others had been doing at Eater LA, but now do that basically exclusively.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Yeah, I saw the In-N-Out story published, which was an interesting sort of like quirky, you know, like deep dive, which gets into the history of the family and whatnot and sort of explores where they are today. It reminds me a little bit of the way you talked about the art's famous chili dog, you know, reminds me a little bit of that sort of like direction of stories. Like, are there any like topics right now that are on the top of your mind that you're like, man, I want to look into that more for this beat?
Oh my gosh. You should see my notes app, like the amount of stories, and anybody, if you ever talk to anybody at Eater, like in our weekly pitch meetings, the amount of times I'm just sort of standing at a desk screaming about a topic that everyone else is like, settle down. That's very, very much my MO. And so I have just lists and lists and lists of things that I want to cover. And having a team that I get to build and hire and bringing that team along to help tell those stories is not only, one, going to help put those stories out into the world faster, but it's also going to sort of relieve me of a little bit of those duties of screaming into a microphone every week for people who might not know what I'm talking about. But the answer is it's really anything. There's a fine dining restaurant out in the middle of the woods near Yosemite that I'm going to be talking about soon. There are places out in the desert that don't get enough traction or attention. There are old histories right here in Culver City, whether that's the founding of Sizzler or somebody who's been doing yakisoba noodles behind a gas station for 25 years. All of that stuff fits into the narrative of what we want to be doing. And if you look back at some of the feature writing that I've done at Eater over the years, whether that's a forgotten style of barbecue that used to exist up and down California to histories, mysterious things, trends, pieces, all of that sort of stuff. I mean, I did a story my last week or 2 weeks at Eater on Tiki Mirage, this amazing, beautiful, hidden tiki bar that is literally inside of a converted U-Haul truck in a parking lot somewhere in Playa Vista. Like, that's a perfect SF Gate story that I happened to tell at Eater LA while I was still there. So there's going to be a ton of overlap. People who are already invested in that sort of stuff are going to find a lot to like at SF Gate.
Can I ask for like that tiki bar story, right? How do you get wind of that? Like, do you, is that cultivating sources?
Some of it is cultivating sources for sure. That's the second channel, the non-news channel of what I really prided myself on at Eater, was being the guy to kind of get to stuff first and meaningfully tell those stories. That's true of Dave's Hot Chicken, of El Russo, of Moose Craft Barbecue, of a bunch of places like that. That's the really fun. The chase part is the really fun aspect of the job. I first went to Tiki Mirage in 2019 when they were operating like very, very underground, just by kind of happenstance, and then stayed in touch with them. And when they were ready to launch in a bigger, broader way and do a collaboration with the Thunderboat folks, it just made sense to kind of meaningfully tell that story. But it's still tricky. You've got to discuss whether or not you're going to obscure names or addresses or hours or ways to even contact people, because there is a quasi-legality to this sort of thing. The same is true of like street food when we cover that. That all needs to be taken into account. But it was really, 4 years in the making in a sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm just always curious how because it seems like, you know, these reporters, they just happen to be at the coolest places all the time, just at the right time, you know? No, it takes a lot more work that we don't see behind the scenes. So you touch on it, but I want to hear quickly about your book, LA Street Food, which you wrote, a decade ago now almost?
Coming up on a decade, yeah. The book came out in 2015. It's called Los Angeles Street Food, A History from Tamaleros to Taco Trucks. And it's equal parts a history of street food in Los Angeles and how we came to be one of the preeminent street food cities, not only in America, but truly in the world. And then the other half was a kind of field guide on where to go to experience different types of street food. And I think the most interesting part of that side of the book is that it's a living document by its very nature. I'm sure a ton of places in the book have closed by now. Many have changed locations or changed operations in some meaningful way. But what I really wanted to dig into was not just the taco stands that you see around, but the everyday vendors, the Coco Fresco vendors, the fruit vendors, the people who do hot dogs after events, the people at Grand Central Market or weekend swap meets like at Alameda, where they are cooking for a very particular audience that you may not otherwise come to interact with. And so I hope that the book is a decent reflection of the full breadth of street food in Los Angeles and not just the taco places that everybody knows about that started on the street.
If you were to edit your book today and add an additional chapter or something, what would you add to your book based on how the scene has evolved?
One, I think night markets are much, much more of a thing than they were at the time when I wrote my book. You saw that through the pandemic, and even now the Alameda Night Market in downtown, what's been happening in Thai Town. There's just an audience there for kind of communal outdoor, sort of dining and streetscapes that make people really excited to go eat, and people hang up string lights and have colorful parties everywhere. And that's really, really fun and something that the scene didn't have close to a decade ago. I would also focus a lot more on the legislation, which is the unsexy part of the whole thing. I get that for an average reader who's picking up a book like mine. But really, the fact that we have no vending zones in the center of Hollywood and the most populated parts of our city, the most touristed parts of our city, the fact that there is still such a lack of meaningful access for most street vendors to actually get what they want, and that enforcement has not only gone up, but the collaboration between street vendors and city officials has largely broken down. There are a few people in the center of that that are trying to make meaningful changes. But for the most part, the city is continuing to operate as if street food is like fully unlicensed and illegal. They didn't even until recently have documentation for approval to get your street food vending license in Spanish. Like, that's so crazy. And so I would probably talk a lot more about that, and as well as the real issues that street vendors face, whether that's extortion or getting robbed at gunpoint or being shooed off their corner by the city. All of that stuff is equally as important now and was under-discussed the book in its beginnings.
Yeah, that's very interesting. We did an episode on that a few months ago, and we had one of the people at the center of that fight on the podcast and learned a lot about the issues you're elucidating right there. And it's sort of shocking when you think about how willing some politicians are willing to tout the street vendors in their neighborhood and be like, oh, I'm the guy that's going to my local pupuseria or whatever. But then the lack of action that they take when it comes to actually enacting meaningful legislation, not just to make sure they can operate, but to protect street vendors,
yeah,
given the sort of like insane numbers of street vendor abuse we've seen over the past like year. It really makes you scratch your head.
Absolutely. And I would even go one step further and to say that there is, this kind of tacit understanding by the public at large. A lot of people want a taco truck that they know and identify with in their neighborhood, but not a lot of people have meaningful conversations with their legislators or people in their communities about why street vendors exist, how long they've existed for, and what they meaningfully can offer to a community, especially at night when there are fewer people out and people may feel less safe. Street vendors are not only historic to this city and endemic to this city, they've been around since the very beginning. They have shaped so much of the way that we dine. I mean, as an aside, I mentioned this in my book, but Grand Central Market was founded in part as a way to try to keep street vendors away from Bunker Hill, where all of the rich white people lived in downtown. And so they created a whites-only market, helped build a small railway down to the market to tell people to go shop here directly. It'll have your butcher and everything you need, and stop buying from Chinese pushcart vendors and tamale guys and everything else. And ultimately, it didn't work. Like, that's how strong and how personal street food vendor relationships are to this city.
Is that what Angel's Flight is about?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh my God.
It wasn't exclusively for Grand Central Market, but that was part of it. That's why they built the market where they did. Angel's Flight is the shortest railway in the world, and it was built to let rich people access another part of the city where market people could sell them ware so that they would stop buying stuff off the street. Absolutely.
Wow, that's so weirdly dystopian and so perfectly Los Angeles that now it's like one of the like city attractions we tout.
The Central American vendors, the Mexican vendors, kept that place alive in the 70s, 80s, and 90s when there used to still be sawdust on the floor. Sarita's Pupuseria is probably the best thing you can eat in that market, and the market would not exist without them.
Wow. Shots fired at Ghost Sando Shop. Okay. Look, I want to, before I get to the final question of the day, I have to ask you about tiny hamsters eating tiny burritos.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The question is this: what?
Great question. Boy, as with every other topic, I have a lot to say. So when I was doing comedy stuff more back in the day, I had friends. This is what, 2014 at this point, 2013 maybe. I had friends in the comedy world who also happened to work in advertising, and they had done a bunch of viral campaigns, but they were always kind of operating in the shadows a little bit. And they said, gosh, we want to make like a kind of statement video that announces who we are a little bit more. The ad agency at the time was called Denizen. And they pitched a large-scale frozen food brand on this idea that let's make a commercial that has us included in it, but is this fun idea of a hamster eating these little tiny burritos and whatever. And Bird's Eye, whoever the company was, they decided, no, thank you. And so they made this video themselves and just branded it entirely themselves. And at the time, I was still freelance writing. And the way I would operate is I would sell stories all over the internet or wherever I could. And I used to find that people had a really hard time. They would ask you, like, where can I read your stuff? And you'd say, well, I have this one story here and this other story is coming out in a week. It's always really complicated. And so my name, Farley Elliott. Farley's a weird name. Elliott has two T's. People always misspell it or don't know what it is. And so I just thought I need a simple name, over, under, which stood at the time for overworked, overfed, and underpaid. And that would that was where it would be like a kind of repository for all of my stuff. So I'd put the first paragraph of the story on that site. You could go and then click through to the website, wherever it was. And any story that I couldn't sell or any little video that I wanted to make that didn't have a home, I would also put it there. So my friends, a long-winded way of saying, knew that I covered food and they knew that I made these little videos sometimes. And so they asked me to help them out and they hired a trained hamster and we figured out what they ate and how we could make it look and shot it in an afternoon. And then before I knew it, it had millions of views on the internet. And for a small window of time, people stopped me on the internet to say, you're the hamster guy.
It is an absolutely phenomenal video. I actually will confess, I had not seen it before I was researching for this podcast. And right. I was just playing it on my laptop. And, you know, my wife was just peering over at my computer and she was like, oh my God, that's so cute. You know, I think it still has a hold on people.
Yes, very charming, very adorable. They since made a series of them. There was one where the hamster gets to meet Mickey Mouse at Disneyland. I mean, there's a children's book. It went crazy. I will say for me, the craziest part was Good Morning America called and wanted to fly me across the country to do a live segment with a hamster. And I was like, absolutely not. I don't know. First of all, it will go poorly. It's a live segment. It's a live animal. I don't know this animal. I'm not even supposed to be in the video. Like, what do you want from me? And so I said no to being on Good Morning America.
Well, that may be one of your regrets on your deathbed, but you know, we'll never find out. Last question I have you, Farley, you've been very generous with your time. We really appreciate it. Where have you enjoyed eating in Los Angeles recently? Where are you eating these days?
Yeah, I'll say my eating is way down in the past few weeks. You know, I used to be out dozens of times a week. That's certainly not the case now, but that'll change and that'll continue to grow again. I've been obsessed with Poltergeist in Echo Park. I think it's the most interesting restaurant in Los Angeles right now. That is not to say that everything is very good. That is not to say that you will enjoy the entirety of the experience. It is to say that there is no more thought-provoking meal that you could have in LA than that right now. I've also been loving Shuntos, which is a Spanish restaurant in Santa Monica, and have been of late obsessed with all things South Bay, whether that's the izakayas or the stuff inside of the Mitsuha markets and the H Mart and you name it. But it's just proof that no matter where I live and my interactions with the city, there's always more to discover. And I love that.
Yeah, no, it's a great way to even think about eating. And I'm really glad you mentioned Poltergeist because you may not know this, but the LA Food Podcast is pretty much the unofficial PR arm of Poltergeist. Mm-hmm. We have talked about it a lot. So that's a great answer. You're speaking to the choir. Farley, thank you very much for joining us. This was a fascinating conversation. Where can people find you if they're looking for you online?
Yeah, you can still find me in all the old ways. I am still overworked, overfed, and underpaid, over, under, everywhere on Instagram. And please don't go to Twitter or X now. It's an awful place, and I don't recommend it. You can also find me at sfgate.com/LA. That's where we will be building out our new audience and making sure that people know that we are here for the long haul and telling meaningful stories. But if you want to reach out, if you've got a question about how we do anything, just hit me up. I may not always be able to help, but I'm certainly always around to chat. So thank you for the time.
We'll put all that in the show notes. Farley, thank you and congratulations again on the new gig. Very excited to see how it all plays out.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the LA Food Podcast. Thanks to our guest, Farley Elliott, for joining us, telling his story, and we wish him all the best as he embarks on this new chapter at SF Gate. If you like what you heard today, dear listener, please go to wherever you listen to podcasts, leave us a rating, a review, subscribe. Seriously, those ratings and reviews really help us, so we really appreciate you taking the time to leave us one. We'll be back next week with another epic episode, and I can't wait, but if you're looking for me in the meantime, you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at the LA Countdown. That's TheLaCountdown. It's an exciting time to find me at the LA Countdown because I'm about 15 sandwiches away from accomplishing my goal of eating 100 epic LA sandwiches in 365 days. So it's getting to crunch time and you're not going to want to miss it. You can also find me on Instagram at LA Food Pod. That's LA FOOD POD. We'll see you next week.